The Lansing Symphony Orchestra's next concert is Saturday night at Wharton Center. Conductor Timothy Muffet says he's quite pleased with the lineup, and he talked with Current State's Melissa Benmark about it.
As I was looking at it in print, it's really a perfect concert, I think, in many ways. That it has, of course, the Mozart Requiem on it, which will bring the people in, and it's an incredible piece of music. And we have a Beethoven symphony, but it's one of the Beethoven symphonies that doesn't get played as much as the others. However, it was Beethoven's favorite. I want to put that one out there. We know from letters that he wrote that of all of his symphonies, his Eighth Symphony, he thought was his best and favorite. And then in the Horizon Expansion Department, we have a classic, another classic, and that's the Webern Symphony, Opus 21. For me, the beautiful thing about this concert is the connection between these three composers. Here's three composers who lived and worked in Vienna, three composers who share the common roots of classicism. The Webern Opus 21 is a decidedly classical work in many ways. We have three composers who inherited a musical tradition and took it in a direction all its own. We have three composers whose music was misunderstood in their time, and three composers who now, as the dust has settled, we look back and recognize that they are all three giants in their day, and these are three works that are remarkable representations of what they did.
The Webern Symphony, it's a short symphony and very mysterious sounding. When I was doing some research for this and I came across the Webern did 12-tone stuff, it was kind of, and so I thought, all right, give it a chance, listen to it. And I found it to actually be very, very internal and very thought-provoking and not painful, frankly, for some people who feel that.
Oh, right. Yeah. No, there's nothing painful about it. It will be for the listener who's not steeped in this tradition. It's unusual, certainly. You know, the three big composers, Schoenberg, who really was the father of serial music, of 12-tone music, Berg and Webern, each took that idea in their own direction. And for Webern, it was a distillation process. And so, as you said, this isn't a very long symphony. It's only 9 minutes. But with Webern, he distills the musical expression process into a very pure form. So whereas a composer such as Schoenberg, who was steeped in the traditions of the late Romantic era of massive, expansive pieces, whereas he may write a phrase that would be 18 or 19 measures long, Webern really gets a phrase down to about two notes. So as the performer, our job is to be hyper-expressive in every single note. Every single note of this piece is an integral part of the statement. This is a classic. It's not like we've pulled something out of the fringe. Musicians and music historians looking back at the 20th century, the Webern Symphony Opus 21 is a classic. And it's a great representation of this, what we call the Second Viennese School, and I think a great introduction for people who maybe are unfamiliar with this music.
The Beethoven, the Symphony Number 8, when it came out, the public seemed to be okay with it, but it didn't make much of a stir. And yet, it's so kind of Haydn-esque and genial. It's like beer with Beethoven, you know?
It totally is. That's a great way to describe it. You know, the problem was the context, that it was on the heels of the Fifth Symphony and the Seventh Symphony, which were just these massive, powerful statements. And you're right, there's a geniality and a Haydn-esque. Those are the two exact terms. And this is something of a testament to Haydn's study, or Beethoven's study with Haydn. I don't know if he wrote it with that in mind, but certainly we hear a lot of Haydn in it. But for me, what I love about it is that it has that sense, that sort of lightness. But there's still quite a bit of real Beethoven in there. I mean, it's got its own sense of drama. It's a very tightly constructed work where there is, much like the Webern, it's one of, I think, Beethoven's more distilled symphonies, in that there's a lot of information in the symphony, but it's condensed into a very pure form.
And I understand he was writing it right around the time that he cut off his relationship with whoever the immortal beloved was.
Right.
And you don't really necessarily hear that in there, or do you?
No, I don't. And which is what we would expect. I mean, it's a real, very much a classical era piece, so we wouldn't expect a composer to be writing, you know, his feelings into it. he's just trying to write a great symphony, and he certainly succeeded.
And then the Mozart Requiem, which really, I suppose that one could contest this, but it kind of is the mother of all requiems, and so many stories are told about it, true and untrue, but I think no matter what stories are true, I think it's hard not to believe that Mozart was real tuned into his own mortality while he was writing this. How does that affect you as a conductor and the performers?
Right. Well, I think all of us in the music profession revere this work, which is interesting because Mozart didn't write it all. I mean, it was a real team effort.
We
know that.
Right, it's kind of a group, yeah.
It began when Mozart started to write it. You know, the myth that of the stranger in gray is true, and that someone came along and said, "We'll pay you to write this piece, but you're not going to get credit for it, and don't ask where the money's coming from," because this guy wanted to pass it off as his own,
and
it was a, you know, kind of a second-rate royalty account or something in a neighboring city. I can't remember all the details, but whose wife had passed away, and he needed a requiem for his wife, and he was known for taking other people's music and passing it off as his own, and so he outsourced this to Mozart. But in the process, I think when Mozart took the commission, he was fine, and then became ill after he had begun it, and recognized that this was in fact going to be among his final compositions. And I don't know any other music of Mozart's that sounds like this one. And I don't know how much of that is the fact that three people were involved in writing it, or if truly Mozart was moving into a new era. Now, he had moved into a new musical style in his recently discovered love of the music of J.S. Bach, which is kind of interesting because the Mozart era of classicism was all a reaction to the ornateness of the Baroque, but yet later in his life, Mozart, and coincidentally Beethoven, did the same thing, looked back and said, "Wow, I love that contrapuntal stuff. I want to write something like that myself." And so we do hear a lot of kind of echoes of the Baroque era of fugues and highly imitative music and very dense textures. So that may be a part of it. I do think maybe Mozart had he lived longer, was moving into a new compositional era for himself. We hear that in the late symphonies, we hear it in Magic Flute, and we certainly hear it in the Requiem. How much of that is because he was on his own deathbed, I don't know.
What part of the Requiem do you enjoy conducting the most, and why?
There are certainly movements that just every time I open up the page and begin to study this music, the Confutatis, Rex Tremendae, which are just so earth-shatteringly dramatic, and then move into music that is sublimely beautiful. I mean, I can't begin to count the hours I've spent with this music over the course of my career, but yet still, every single time, those sections really come back and have a deep impact.
Timothy Muffet, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.